This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, who is ready and waiting for your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So, Kevin, did you do something productive with your extra hour that we gained when we fell back for daylight saving time last weekend?
It is such a sad comment on my life, Joy, that extra hour of sleep, this daylight savings day, spring back, fall forward, whatever it is, that feels like Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, my birthday all rolled into one special day for that extra hour of sleep. So yes, I did something very productive. I caught up on my beauty sleep.
I love that extra hour of sleep. It feels so good. And we will be talking about something else with the onset of daylight saving time that you should be thinking about a little bit later in the program. But for now, let's start off, Kevin, with this good news, bad news about Social Security, that the Social Security Administration released some new numbers, and all of us are going to be affected. How so?
Yeah, these are for 2014, and for better, for worse, the checks are going to be going up, the ones that go out to people, about 1.5% over 2013's amount. That compares to a 3.6% increase in 2012 and a 1.7% increase in 2013. And just for so people can get some perspective, the average retiree check right now for 2013 from Social Security is $1,275. And that average check under the increase next year would go up to $1,294. So about an extra $19 or so going up. The good news for retirees, though, is many of those people who are receiving Social Security checks also pay a Medicare premium, and that is not going up. That has gone up in the past, and a lot of times when it has gone up, it's actually outweighed the increase that people receive from the checks. So net-net, retirees and other recipients should be getting a little bit more money next year.
A little more money for recipients. Is there any other good news?
Yes, the earnings test for recipients. This is what people are technically usually eligible for Social Security retiree benefits at age 62. And there's a penalty if they also earn money over a certain dollar amount and collect benefits. And typically what happens is they lose a dollar in benefits for every $2 in earnings over that ceiling, if you will. In 2013, that amount was $15,120, and that will be going up to $15,480 in 2014. So you'll be able to earn a little bit more, not be penalized for it. Now, keep in mind, when they set this earnings test, it's only for a Social Security recipient's earnings, not interest or pension check, and not spousal earnings, and it's only until you reach what they call normal retirement age, which is about 66 years, give or take a few months right now.
Okay, and there's also, though, some not-so-good news with the Social Security numbers released.
That's right. This is part of the inflation increase. They bump the checks up a little bit, but they also bump the amount of earnings that are subject to Social Security taxes for workers. It was $113,700 this year. That will be bumped up to $117,000 next year. So if you're an employee, you'll pay an extra 7.65% between Medicare and Social Security taxes, give or take, and so will your employer. Works out to about $200 each if you make more than $113,700 more. But that's about, I think, probably 10 million people or something are going to be subjected to that. So, again, making that kind of money is a good problem to have, but you will pay more in Social Security taxes next year.
Is there anything else we should know about this data?
Well, all of the changes are inflation adjusted, except for one very important one for retirees, and that is the taxation of benefits in retirement. And this is kind of a means testing of Social Security. Technically, when you receive a Social Security check in retirement, it's not taxable unless your income reaches a certain amount. Then all of a sudden it triggers a taxation on Social Security. And those numbers were set about 30 years ago, and they've never been adjusted upward For inflation. They've remained perfectly static, and they the originators of the rule knew exactly what they were doing. And in fact, if you can remember, inflation was much higher 30 years ago, so they're actually disappointed that less people are getting snared by this. So more retirees are going to be paying income taxes on their Social Security just by the nature of inflation and the dollar value of their Social Security going up.
Got it. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and in Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin about a money matter, a personal finance issue, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag, and Vicki says, I am asking this question for my daughter in Louisville. She recently graduated from college and got a job in her field. She has three loans, the largest at $16,800 at 6.8% interest, the second at $8,000 at 3.4% interest, and the third at $1,700 at 4.5% interest. She has not found any other way to lessen the interest rate on the largest loan. Could you, Kevin, submit this to you to your very large financial brain to see if there is something she could do? There we go.
Congratulations, Vicki, on your daughter. She's on the ball not only for having a job out of college, but also looking to lower her interest rate on her student loans. Difficult to consolidate those federal student loans without actually getting behind, unless you're really in trouble and start missing payments. That's the only way really you can consolidate it, and that's definitely not worth it in this case. And I don't think that, while I certainly commend the effort of her daughter to try to lower the interest rate, paying 6.8% on a student loan is really not that big of a deal, especially compared to the advantages.
Why do you say it's not a big deal?
Well, let's say she were able to bring that 6.8% rate down to 3.4%, the lower one the lowest one she's paying right now, and half of what the current rate is. She would actually only save about $30 per month in payments, and she may lose some of the advantages of the being a part of the federal loan program.
What are the advantages of that?
There is an income-based repayment plan where students with federal loan amounts, generally it has to exceed their annual income, but there are some other metrics that are applied as well. But they can reduce their payment and still stay current on the loan, and they can reduce it to a very small amount. Still, you know, you have to make the payment, but it can be reduced to a much smaller amount, much more affordable amount based on their income. And eventually, and it's over several years, if the payments are made on time and at least the minimum is made, that a remaining balance could be forgiven. And you can find out more info about it at ibrinfo.org, ibrinfo.org. And the Fed is actually publicizing this program, saying many of these students who are not making enough money to pay off their loans are eligible for this program but aren't participating in it. So they're really encouraging people to get out there, go and take a look at it. And they're also talking about some other issues that people have with repaying student loans.
And what are some of those other issues?
They want to make sure that students who are eligible for loan forgiveness know about it. This is usually when they're working in selected occupations and areas or have public service jobs if they have federal loans. And the website finaid.com, finaid.com, has a great list of all the different programs, not just for the federal loans, but if you work in a particular occupation in a selected area, you may be eligible for loan forgiveness. Sometimes it's a couple of years, sometimes it's 10 years or 15 years, but people with a large student loan burden definitely would need to know about it. And also it shows that with these advantages of the federal student loans, families who are sending kids to college or people who are trying to pay for college themselves should definitely get the federal loans first when they're eligible rather than use savings first, because you can always use your savings to pay off the loan if it's there. But if the programs go away or if you need the savings for some other emergency, you not only can make the payment slower on the loan, but you also get an option to eventually either lower your payment or get an outright forgiveness from it.
So, Kevin, I'm wondering, has anybody before Vicky complimented you on your large financial brain mass?
I think the last time I was sized for a hat, and it wasn't really a comment on my brain. It was more like, what's wrong with your head? You should have a doctor look at that.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and the managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have an email for him that we might consider for a future email segment, send it to onyourmoney@wpr.org or call right now, 1-800-642-1234. Let's take some calls. We already have full lines, and Amanda in Pigeon Falls is with us first. Hi, Amanda, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about actually the income-based repayment program and the public loan forgiveness. Public service loan forgiveness. I'm enrolled in both of those programs, but I was wondering, since I'm paying so little every month, does it affect my credit score because the interest keeps accruing on my account, or is because I'm making the payments every month, does that just keep my credit at a good level?
It will affect it a little bit, not as much as you might fear, and things like balances are on debt are probably about equally important with just actually making payments on time. And so when they look at those balances, student loan does not get as debt does not get hit as hard on your credit report as, say, a credit card or any kind of other unsecured loan that you might have. And so many people have student loans that if lenders said, well, we're not going to lend money to people who have student loans out, they wouldn't be in business for very long. So, right, you should still try to pay that off if and when you can as soon as possible. And what I'd recommend, Amanda, is that if, let's say, you had extra money that you could be making but payments on, but you only are just going to make the minimum payment required under the PSLF and the IBR, the income-based repayment and public service loan forgiveness, I'd keep that money in savings if you can. And then when you need to buy something and you need to apply for credit, maybe they ding you and say, I'm sorry, Amanda, you still have too much on student loans. Then you have a choice. You can use that cash you've accumulated to either pay off some of the student loans and boost your credit score, or just use cash to actually buy the thing you're trying to buy with credit instead. And it gives you a little bit more option without, you know, sending all the money into the loan payment that you can't, quite frankly, you can't ever get it back once you send the payment in.
Good luck, Amanda. Thanks for calling. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Your Money, some end-of-the-year financial moves that you should consider. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to send it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Pat in Appleton. Hi, Pat.
Greetings, salutations. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for calling.
And by the way, Sir McKinley, I have had a recent religious experience, and I am now a full-time member of the McKinley Church of Finance. Hobby-gobby.
Yeah, we meet in my garage. It's still a pretty small group, but I think it's your turn to bring the coffee this time, Pat.
and the goulash, don't you know? I'm a small business owner. I've got two full-time employees and about four or five part-timers. And I've thrown myself into permanent debt by actually building my own building and financing that, of course. It's an LLC. And my question is this, and what's based upon this. Obviously, with any kind of a building situation, there's going to be cost overruns, and I was prepared for that. Mm-hmm. I've always had a personal credit rating well over 800. And, of course, you're always getting credit cards for 0% and so on and so forth. And so I kind of use those for those cost overruns. My question to you concerning this is because now obviously my credit rating has gone down because I've got so much money on those credit cards. I'm wondering, A, if there may be an opportunity to consolidate those costs that are on my personal named credit cards, albeit the purchases were all for the business. And the point of that, of course, is to perhaps lower the interest rate when those 0% come off and also to improve the personal credit rating.
Okay, so you're saying you built up, and this is very common, you use credit cards to finance this building, and now you're wondering what to do with these. Is there a way that you can kind of maneuver them so that they don't come back to bite you if and when the interest rates rise, correct?
Right.
Okay. As part of your great credit rating pattern and your business, are you getting credit card offers directed to your business ever in the mail?
No, I'm not getting any credit card offers now simply because I've got, you know, the totals are up there higher now. Now they're saying, ooh.
Okay. What have you talked to a lender, like at a bank or credit union?
I have not yet, because I didn't know whether or not this would be a feasible thing to broach.
Sure. It's something to keep in mind that those people sitting behind those desks, you know, waiting for applications, the only way they really get paid is when loans are made. And they can't give the money out from the financial institution to just anybody. But they have an incentive to try to give you the loan that you want and need. And especially if you've had a decent credit rating in the past, and it's still probably pretty good right now, if the payments are current, probably not as good, but still pretty good, there's a very good chance that they could give you, they might, you know, securitize the loan against the building, or they may just say, you know what, you have great credit standing, and you have good other income and assets, et cetera. We're just going to give you a personal loan, and we'd like to see you pay those credit cards off with that loan and then pay us back. You might end up paying, you know, a little bit more in interest right now, obviously, because they might charge you 8 to 10%, but at least you get a longer period of loan. You get a fixed rate. You get a chance to deduct the interest on that as well, and it's something that that might be more predictable for you going forward, and then you can always pay it off whenever you want if something else should come up. So I would I'd go call up your local credit union or bank, especially if you have one with whom you have a relationship, and see what they say. And the worst thing they can do is say no. But I would be surprised if they weren't able to come up with some solution to say, okay, we see what you did, we see this all the time, and so here's what we can offer you to help you fix the situation. And if they say we can't help you, go find somebody else, because you might find another institution who is more amenable that day.
Thanks, Pat, for the call. Good luck. And hey, send us your goulash recipe when you have a chance. We should have On Your Money potlucks, don't you think?
That's a great idea. You let me know when those are.
I will. Kim in Kenosha is with us now. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks for
inviting. We prefer those rather than the long-time callers and first-time listeners. Thank you,
Kim. Right. Okay, so my question is about my children's education savings accounts. Right now we have, my daughter is 8, and we started a Coverdell with her, for her, through State Farm. And she's got a few thousand dollars in there, and we are looking at starting something for my son, but I don't know if we want to do another Coverdell for him, or like the 529, or if we want to just do like a Roth IRA. So I guess I'm looking for advice to see what our best options are. We don't put a ton of money in it every year, maybe like a few thousand, but just, you know, kind of want to know the best option.
Yeah, the Coverdell is a much less used option. It's similar to a 529 account, but I prefer the 529 account if indeed you are focusing on higher education, post-high school expenses. Let me ask you this, Kim. Are you looking for just the smartest thing to do, or is this a lot of times when people are saving for children or grandchildren, it's a philosophical thing where they say, well, it feels good to put some money in this kid's name because then it shows that I'm actually doing something for it and they won't get mad at me and never speak to me after they turn 18 and don't have any money for college?
Yeah, it's kind of like that.
Okay. It's understandable. If that's the case, then I like the 529 accounts because you maintain ownership of the account. It's in the kid's name as a beneficiary, but you can change the beneficiary whenever you want. You can name successor trustees to the account, meaning you say, well, what happens if something happens to me, who will take over the account? You can name another family member or something, or the kid's guardians. And I'd prefer that over the Coverdell. And then as the absolute most laser-like focus on the smartest thing to do, I actually prefer the Roth IRA, because if you're eligible for it and you make contributions to it, you can pull those contributions back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties. Now, this would be a Roth IRA in your name, and it's your money. And let's say your daughter gets to school in 10 years. She needs a bunch of money. You can pull that money out of the Roth, the contribution portion, tax-free with no penalties whatsoever. Use it to pay for college. But it's better to borrow money for college than it is to borrow money for retirement. It's a lot easier. So it's a priority to save for retirement first. So if you want, just the smartest thing to do, max out your Roth IRAs first. And if you have anything left over, then that can go into the 529 plans.
Perfect. Okay. And to open a Roth IRA, do you just, is that through your bank or is that through like Vanguard or something like that?
Yes.
How do you open?
You can go to a bank, credit union, Vanguard, Schwab, Fidelity, local investment house, insurance companies offer them. There are hundreds of places within the state of Wisconsin who will be more than happy to open up a Roth IRA for you. I like those lower cost, kind of discount financial services companies. But if you want to meet someone face to face, credit union or an investment firm is a good place to go to.
Kim, thanks very much for calling. It didn't hurt at all that first time. Has a caller ever said, I'm a second-time caller, Kevin?
We've had second-time callers, but they won't admit it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you can be a first or a second-time caller or a third-time caller by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and our next caller is Jean in Oshkosh. Hi, Jean. What number is this for you?
This is many times.
Okay.
And I feel absolutely terrible because this is the dumbest question I've ever asked. IRAs, regular IRAs, two of them have just come due. Let's just say that they are rounded pretty much to $25,000 each. My question is, And we have been able to trace the lineage back through, I think, three different banks, and we've just rolled over the corpus. My question is, I can't determine when we started this because these two go back a long time. When do you pay the tax on the corpus? I know that you pay the tax on the interest, but if you do that, what about the next time when these have rolled over? When is the tax operative?
Well, Robert, we have a philosophy here at On Your Money. There are no dumb questions.
Mm-hmm.
Except for that one. That one, boy, it really hit it out of the park.
That's the dumbest question I've ever heard.
No, it's actually a very good question, and I'm glad you asked. When these are rolling over, you're not taking possession of the money, are you?
No.
Okay. As long as they keep rolling over, there is no taxation on it. However, unless they're after-tax IRA accounts, meaning you did not take a tax deduction on the deposit, you pay taxes on it whenever you pull it out, whether that's now or when you die and your beneficiaries pull it out or when you turn 70 and a half. That is the time that it's taxed. But it's all taxed. Withdrawals are taxed as ordinary income. Now, you might not pay much in taxes on that because you're in a lower income bracket, but it is technically taxable income if and when you pull it out and put it into your checking account.
Both the corpus and the interest earned on that during its life.
Yes, sir. And you said they are not after-tax IRAs, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. If they're not after-tax IRAs, then yes, you pay taxes on whatever you pull out. It's very simple. If you take $1,000 out of that account, you've got $1,000 of taxable income.
Okay.
That was an excellent question, Gene.
Yes, it was.
Thank you so much for it. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. It is time now for Smart Assets. Over the next few weeks, we will be spending this time talking to you about some year-end financial moves that you should consider. And what is on tap for this week, Kevin?
Today, we'll address one for those who are retired and do need to withdraw money from an IRA. And this is generally under the required minimum distribution. Very frightening for people and very tricky. And then next week, we'll talk about when you have to take it out under your own choice.
So what about the RMD first?
Yeah, you have to make sure that you take it. It's from any IRA, tax-deferred retirement account, what have you, and it's generally for people who are over 70 and a half. You have to take the first payment out by April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half, and then you'll have to take another one out later in that same year. And then after that, what happens is you add up the previous year end balance of all your retirement accounts and divide it by an IRS factor that's based on your life expectancy. And the factor gets larger every single year that you're alive, so that you end up taking out a greater percentage of the IRA every single year and then taking taxes out. And you want to make sure that you take at least as much out as the RMD by the deadline, because if you don't take it out, the IRS imposes a 50% excise tax on what you were supposed to take out, and you still have to pull it out and pay taxes on it. So if you were supposed to take out, say, $6,000 and you didn't by the year or the end of the year, you have to pay a $3,000 excise tax, and then you still have to take the $6,000 out as soon as you can and pay taxes on that as well.
Ouch, I wish I knew why. Why are they making me take this out? Anyway, is that just for those who are 70 and a half?
Generally, it's for those who are over 70 and a half, but it's also for people who now we're seeing a generation who started IRAs in the 70s and 80s who had retirement accounts from that time. We're starting to pass away, and they're passing on these IRAs to beneficiaries. Beneficiaries also have to take out required minimum distributions generally, especially if they're not the spouse. And so they also have to be conscious of this, and in what where this is going to happen soon as well. Inherited Roth IRAs. Roth IRAs are neat because they have no mandatory distribution while the Roth IRA owner is alive, meaning they can be left in the account forever until the owner passes away and then passes the account on to a beneficiary. The beneficiary then has to start taking out required minimum distributions as well.
So that's for people who have to withdraw money from their retirement accounts. Why would someone choose to take money out if they didn't have to?
That's an interesting strategy that we'll talk about next week, because people who are in the lower income tax bracket, generally below the 15% federal income tax bracket, and especially when they are retired and not earning much money or if any at all, and only have like Social Security or pension payments, those people may want to take money out from an IRA that they don't necessarily need to take out according to the law, or don't even need to spend for that matter, and convert it to a Roth IRA. And so next week we're going to talk about not only why one would want to do that, but how you would go about it and some of the very unique planning opportunities with converting some of an IRA to a Roth IRA.
Okay, we will look forward to that. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Here every week at this time, or just about every week at this time, with information and advice on your money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Robert in Onalaska. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hello, Kevin and Joy. In the 1970s, my company had a stock option plan, and I took part in it. At that time, $28 per share, this paid for the stock about 80% of the value at that time. And then now in 2013, I had 216 shares. I sold them this year for $33.50 per share. A total of $11,700, but I don't have any record of showing this except the amount I got. Will I have anything? How will that be handled on taxes? I'm wondering.
Are you in a lower income tax bracket right now, Robert? Is your income tax bill pretty low? Okay. The good news is that you should make your best effort to take whatever documentation you have that shows and put that into the system. The rule is, the letter of the law is, that if you don't know the cost basis and you can't verify it, you have to use zero as the cost basis. And then the bad news about that, of course, is that all of the sales proceeds technically become taxable capital gains. However, for people in the 15% tax bracket or lower, that's usually something they pay hardly any tax on at all. And even above it, the long-term capital gains rate is very small. I think it's worth it. Do you do your own taxes, Robert, or do you pay someone to do it?
I've been going down to the IRP people.
Okay, this might be a year where you would actually procure the services of a real-life CPA to help you navigate this one. Not so much that I'm worried that, you know, the IRS is going to get upset with you, but just to get an expert opinion other than mine, because quite frankly, I'm not going to sit with you in front of the auditor and say, well, I gave him this answer on the air over the
radio. Right.
But contact the CPA. You can probably spend $500 to $700 to do it, but you have some money in your hand from the sale proceeds of that, and it's worth it to get a backup on the opinion of how to proceed. Some of those tax people will tell you, you know what, put in your best estimate, and if you get audited, let them prove what you paid for it. That was a tack that you probably could have taken a few years ago, but the IRS is getting more serious about trying to get the accurate cost basis and taxable proceeds under the letter of the law, and therefore they might get a little bit more persnickety about this. And so I'd want you to try to adhere to it, not have to wait up. Again, the tax bill, you know, it might be a few thousand dollars if it comes to that. It won't be extraordinary, but I'd want to make sure more so that you just report the accurate numbers and then pay whatever you owe. Again, go with a CPA, find one locally, and he or she should be able to help you.
Good luck, Robert. Thank you for calling. Carolyn DePere is with us now. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. I have a question about transferring money to my grandchildren. Maybe I'm just too lazy to go out and buy gifts, but really that wasn't the reason. They're fairly young yet, and it's two different families. Both of them, at the time that the children will apply for any kind of post-secondary education, are going to need financial assistance. And so my husband and I have been giving money at the birthday and Christmas. And I just did some quick figures. It isn't going to be much, but by the time the kids are 17, it's probably going to amount to about $8,000, because neither family will use that unless we decide that it's going to be a problem. Both my son and daughter are saying when they apply for college assistance, this is going to be a problem. Would they be better off to use that money during the kids' high school years and get rid of it before they have to apply? I just don't know what to do. We're trying to do the right thing, but I don't want it to be a problem when they have to put figures on paper.
Mm-hmm. Right. I hope that it becomes a problem. I don't think it will, and here's why. Even if the money is the money in the kids' like savings account or a mutual fund?
It's in a uniform transfer to minors.
Sure. Okay. It's in the kid's name. It will count. The university will, or the college will probably count about half of the balance each year as part of the family's expected family contribution. Meaning, if there's $8,000 in the kid's name, they'll say, "Hey, before you get any need-based aid, you have to pony up about $4,000 of that account, and then $2,000 the next year, $1,000, et cetera." And most financial aid is in loans, and the majority of it is anyway, and very little of it it comes in the way of just straight out need-based scholarships, unless you're going to a very expensive, usually private or out-of-state institution, and even then, the aid usually brings the price down to what you'd pay for, you know, a decent in-state school tuition cost. In rare cases, that can differ, of course. So I'm less interested in or less worried about the financial aid implications. What I'm more concerned about is when it's in an UTMA account, like you say, that's the kid's money that he or she can use whenever she wants upon reaching adulthood, which, you know, depending on the state, can be 18 to early 20s. And there's nothing really that you or the parents can do to stop them from doing that other than, you know, hit them on the backside with a yardstick or something. So that I have a bigger issue with. If you get some smart aleck kid who finds out about the account, and sometimes they find out about it because they're applying for financial aid, and they say, "Well, I want that money. I'm going to take it out of there." They can under the letter of the law. So what I would prefer you do is exactly what you said: spend that money on things that the kids would spend money on otherwise, and it has to be for their basic need. It can't be, you know. It can't be for video games or something like that, or for presents. It can be for a car. It can be for braces. It can be private school tuition. It can be for band camp, athletic fees, whatever. But then the money that don't spend it just to spend it, but use that money to spend on the kid's benefit, and then use an equal dollar amount in the parent's case and put that in a 529 account with you or the parents on as the owner. Then that will remove some of that money from the financial aid picture, the need-based financial aid picture. But more importantly, it will allow the parents to keep control over the funds if they don't want the kid to get it. Because in a 529, if the parents or the owner of the account does not want the kid to get it, he or she doesn't get it.
Does the 529 account count on the parents' income tax?
Parents' income tax or financial aid?
Yeah, are they going to run into trouble if we tell them, don't put this into the transfer minors, but start a 529 account?
Nope, you can give this year's $14,000 to anyone you like, and so technically you can put $14,000 in a given year into a 529 account, and then the earnings are tax sheltered, and so there's no reporting or anything like that of earnings on the parents' side for it, nor is there for the gift, and the only time there would be a tax issue is when they pulled the money out and did not use it for qualified higher education expenses. Then there would be a small penalty and a tax on the earnings portion of whatever they, they put in $10,000 and pulled out $11,000. They would only pay the penalty and the taxes on the $1,000 difference of the $11,000 total. So even that will be very small. So I'd like to see them move the money into a 529, but you can do it by spending the UTMA account down and then using an equal amount of money to put into the 529 account.
Thanks and good luck, Carol. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Guess what we're going to talk about next? With the onset of daylight saving time, it's not just about changing your clocks, but something else, Kevin.
Yes, it's a good time to check the smoke detectors in your house. First of all, that you have them. Second of all, check the battery, make sure it's working. And you might think that you just, reach up and get on a wobbly chair and push that little red button, get an annoying shriek out of it, and you're good to go. But actually, that's just the bare minimum of testing and safety requirements that you should take. And there are lots of other steps you should take if you'd like to be safe rather than sorry.
All right, so where do we start?
Well, start with testing that battery and getting the beep. But even if it works, so you might want to replace it anyway. It might fail later between now and the next time that you test it. And, they say you should actually test this every month. I'd be surprised if most people test it every year. Maybe have a party, come over. Hey, come on over. We're going to test the smoke detectors and bring your goulash. So you don't want that battery to fail later when you need it the most. And when you do replace the battery, this is one time we're a big fan of rechargeable batteries, but this is a time when you may want to use a brand new but disposable battery because it's less likely to leak the charge over time. And then write the date on a little piece of tape on the side of the detector, not only when you tested it, but when you replace the battery.
All right. So after that annoying beep, then what?
See if it actually detects smoke. And this is not by, cooking up a pan of bacon directly underneath it, although that can be a good idea too. There's a special kind of spray that you can use that you spray it into the smoke detector and it simulates the smoke and checks it to see if it actually will detect smoke without, burning out the sensors for it. It's available online. We'll have a link at Amazon.com, or you can also get one at your local hardwood store or your big box retailer.
I never heard of that. So what if it doesn't work? What if it doesn't detect that?
It might be time to replace it altogether, and especially if it's more than 10 years old. That's usually the useful life of most smoke detectors. And the best kind are those that are actually wired into your home's electrical system rather than relying solely on a battery. But they do use a battery then as a backup, so if the power goes out, you still got some help there. And then they're interconnected so that if one goes off, they all go off. So you don't have to worry about trying to hear one that's going off in the basement while you're upstairs in bed at night. And there are two different kinds of sensors in smoke detectors. There's one that's ionization. That detects heat and flame. And then photoelectric sensors detect smoke and smoldering. And either one of those things is a problem. If you only have one kind of detector, you may miss out on the other kind of danger. So you want to try to find not only a detector that hopefully has both kinds of sensors, but even one that also has a combination carbon monoxide sensor in there as well.
Mm-hmm. And how many of these do I need? Where should I be putting them?
Every floor for sure, but also in the hallways and the staircases, near bedrooms especially. You want to put it near the kitchen but not directly in, because if you put it in, you'll get a lot of false alarms again every time you fry up the bacon. And then maybe one down in the basement, especially on the stairway, so that if there's a problem with the furnace or the water heater or something, hopefully that one will alert the family as well.
Well, that sounds like that's going to cost a lot of money to put that many detectors. What does this run us?
Well, let's look at it over, let's say, a 10-year period. And let's say it costs $500, which if I were to receive a bill for this, I would give a little pause before paying it. But that works out to about $4 per month, or a little over a dime a day. And you may get a reduction on your homeowner's insurance premium if you have a sophisticated enough alarm. So check with your homeowner's insurance provider and say, I'm thinking about ramping up my smoke and carbon monoxide detection. Is there any way that I'll, you know, get some kind of rebate for it or get a discount for it? And then look at it, the expenses, life insurance or other kinds of insurance, where whatever you spend on it, you hope it becomes a big waste of time and money.
Right. Better safe than sorry. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin about a personal finance matter, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And Kathy in Holman is with us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Yes, what's your question, Kathy?
Well, I'm 60 years old, and I'm retired, and I have four 403Bs, and I opened them without having a trust company. Only one of them has some sort of an overarching organization that manages it and charges me fees. I'd like to move them all into socially responsible funds. I'm working with a financial planner who works for an organization, and he's got some socially responsible funds that are available through their company, but they have a front-end load. And because these 403Bs have accrued quite a bit of value, especially in the last year or so, I'm reticent to do that at this time. I'm wondering if there's a better alternative, some sort of trust company or something, that when I have to take out the RMDs, it's all under one umbrella.
That's a good plan, and that's one of the downfalls of having separate different accounts, obviously, is that you usually have to coordinate all of the different accounts yourself and then try to make sure you're taking out enough for it. And then also you want, you know, it's consolidated, it's easier for you to keep track of, it's easier for the planner to take care of, and then more importantly, your heirs will have an easier time finding that money if you're not around to tell them where it is. And so I applaud the move. The sales charge is probably troublesome. It's also how this advisor is getting paid. I don't like front-end sales charges generally, because it's kind of like starting the summer off and a kid comes to your front door and says, hey, I'll mow your lawn every week for the next summer. Give me $300 right now. And you'd say, well, I'll pay you to do that, but I'll pay you, you know, $20 every time you do it. And so I prefer that people work with an advisor on a fee basis, because then it gives the advisor more flexibility to move investments from one place to another without worrying about incurring a whole new sales charge. And then also it gives the advisor an incentive to give you ongoing service, which is what you want from this, without paying a big chunk up front. You can go to direct sold mutual funds, and you can, you know, you'll get a call center, if you will. They might be a little less expensive. They might not have a sales charge. And if you look up socially responsible investing, you'll find several different funds that do offer. I think Parnassus is one that offers direct funds, meaning there's no sales charge on it. And again, for better or for worse, you also don't get the face-to-face service usually that you would from a planner or someone is you know, charging you a fee or selling you commission for it. Vanguard has a few different low-cost funds. Some of them have some social aspect to it, but not very much. And there are some out there, but it's very difficult to find very low-cost, socially responsible funds, especially if you have a very narrow criteria of what you're willing to put your money into. So you might end up just having to bite the bullet, pay this person for that, and hope you get it. Another thing you might think of, Kathy, is if ask the advisor and say, are there C shares available with these? You're talking about A shares right now, where there's an upfront sales charge, but then that's generally all you pay. There's some minor fees down the road every single year, but it's generally small. C shares
don't charge any initial sales charge to you, but they charge 1% per year onto the expense ratio, and that 1% per year goes to the advisor so that the advisor doesn't make as much money up front but might make more money by serving you well over, say, 6 or 8 years or whatever. And that, again, gives the advisor a financial incentive to keep you happy and provide good service to you.
Good for you, Kathy, and best wishes. Let's go to Jim in New Berlin next. Hello, Jim.
Morning. Yes, years ago I made a mistake of getting an annuity, and it's about half of my retirement. And someone mentioned an immediate annuity, and what I have now is a variable one with different categories that you can invest in. But when I turned 65, someone mentioned immediate annuity. Could you explain how that works and what the tax implications would be when I withdraw that?
Sure. Was the annuity, Jim, was it part of your retirement account? Like, did you buy it within a 403B, 401K, or IRA?
No, I made the mistake on my own.
Okay. Well, acknowledging it is a first step. So, and I hope that's the biggest financial mistake you ever make, Jim. So don't feel too bad about it. An immediate annuity is basically an arrangement with an insurance company where they look at you, figure out how long they think you're going to live, and then you give them a bunch of money, and they divide that amount of money over your expected life and say, we're going to pay you this amount of money every single month, either over a certain time period or over your life or over your life and the beneficiary, what have you. Here's the problem with it. You're making a bet with someone, in this case the insurance company, and the insurance company has to not only invest your money to support the payments to you, but also make profits and pay their expenses. And so they have a choice, which is either to invest it aggressively and try to make more money over what they're going to owe you and pay for expenses, or to invest it conservatively to make sure that it's going to be around for you at least as long as you're expecting the payments. And when in this extremely low interest rate environment we're in right now, it's very difficult for them to offer you any payment that's a whole lot better than just burying your money in the backyard and pulling a similar amount out every single month as to what the annuity is going to promise you. We'll put a link up at onyourmoney.com, but I think if you go to immediateannuities.com, you can see what kind of calculations I'm talking about. And the payments sound pretty good at first, but then when you realize, well, if I only live this long, this is the same kind of money that I would get if I were to just exhaust it myself, and I'd always have access to the money if interest rates rise and take out a CD or move it into a different kind of investment. So I'd prefer that you don't take that out. I would rather have you just take out a little bit each month, say, from the variable annuity and let nature take its course rather than sealing the deal with an immediate annuity.
All right, Jim, I hope that helps. Thanks very much for the call. I guess it's time now, Kevin, for the website of the week.
That's right. Veterans Day is Monday, and there are several entities that offer very good deals to veterans, not only on Monday, but year-round. Military.com has the links to all of those different deals, and we'll put that link up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Well, good. That sounds very good. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He is with us every week at this time with information and advice on your money. If you have a personal finance question, you can email Kevin at onyourmoney@wpr.org. onyourmoney@wpr.org. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Marika Saval for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.